11 minutes before 8 a.m., you are tuned into Raven Radio, KCAW in Sitka. Today is Wednesday, April 2nd, 2014. I'm Melissa Marconi-Wenzel with Raven News. A bill that would symbolically make 20 Alaska Native languages official state languages is heading to the House floor for a vote. House Bill 216 was introduced by Sitka Democrat Jonathan Christ Tompkins. The House State Affairs Committee yesterday unanimously passed the bill less than a week after some Republicans on the panel raised concerns about the bill's potential ramifications. Tlingit Elder Selena Everson became emotional during Tuesday's public testimony.
Our language is our very being. It's our culture. We were brought up with such respect to each other, to the Tlingit people, the Haida people, the Tsimshian people, the Yupik, the whole state of Alaska, with all the different languages being spoken. It would be an honor to be recognized.
While English is the only official language of Alaska, the state Supreme Court in 2007 struck down part of a 1998 voter initiative, making it the only language in which government business can be conducted. Last week, Republican Representatives Doug Isaacson, Lynn Gattis, and Wes Keller raised concerns that HB 216 would be misinterpreted by future legislatures or the courts. They worried that could lead to unintended consequences, such as ballots or legislation having to be printed in every official language. A new version of the bill adopted at today's hearing makes clear that the official designation for Alaska Native languages is only symbolic. But Lance Twitchell, a Native languages professor at the University of Alaska Southeast, said the bill means more than that to supporters.
This is more than symbolic. This is historic. History will not remember you for specialized license plates and parking ticket processes. History will remember you for this moment right here, what you say and do when we ask you to help us live, to find a brighter future for our languages, cultures, and people.
House Bill 216 must still be scheduled for a vote on the House floor. The bill has not been considered by the state Senate. Meanwhile, a measure setting up a road and ferry savings account has cleared its first state Senate committee. What's called the Transportation Infrastructure Fund would also pay for airport, harbor, and similar projects. House Joint Resolution 10 has gained support from construction and development groups. At a recent hearing, Tom Bryce said the three laborers' unions he represents support the measure.
It breaks down some constitutional barriers that exist in terms of establishing long-term planning for the transportation needs of the state.
Wrangell Republican Representative Peggy Wilson authored the resolution, which the House approved in March. It passed out of the Senate Transportation Committee yesterday. Wilson told the panel the measure resurrects a system used in territorial days.
There were already two transportation funds in existence before we became a state. One was for roads and one was for ferries and harbors, water and harbors. And so we're combining both of them into one.
The next stop is the Senate Finance Committee, then the Chamber's floor. Wilson's resolution would put a constitutional amendment before voters in November. Passage would allow the fund to be created. Separate bills establishing and appropriating $2 billion into the fund are not expected to pass this year. Wilson says that will come later. She says the fund would pay for more transportation projects. Critics, including the governor, say it could shrink the amount of money spent. An environmental activist from Oregon is returning to serve as the executive director of the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council. Melina Marvin began her environmental career in Southeast, like many of her colleagues, from the seat of a kayak, Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Melina Marvin says she's been in love with Southeast since she visited Duren College. She interned for watershed protection councils in Haines, Skagway, and Yakutat, and she went on to teach Tonga science and policy classes, which were held on the water, in kayaks.
This last year, teaching my course, I started learning more about the industrial development plan for the cross-border watersheds, you know, with the Stikine and the Taku, and got pretty concerned about that, started digging into it. And so when I saw the job with SEAC come up, I saw that as an opportunity for me to really weigh in and have a say on that issue.
Marvin spent the past 5 years as communications director for an Oregon group called Klamath Riverkeeper. It campaigned to remove major dams on the salmon-producing river. That's one of the reasons she got the job.
I hope that she brings a whole other bunch of new tools in terms of how we communicate with our members and the community at large.
Clay Frick is president of CX Board of Directors.
She's dealt with very complex issues in the Klamath River issues, such as water rights, tribal concerns. So she brings that experience to the table.
CX's new executive director says the organization will continue opposing the Juneau Access Project, also known as the Lynn Canal Highway. The full plan would extend the capital city's road system north to a terminal with ferries sailing to Haines and Skagway, but Marvin notes there's only partial funding.
The facts are that the Juneau Road would not connect Juneau to the road system, which I think a lot of folks don't understand, but would in fact connect it to the Kensington Mine. So we're looking at a $500 million subsidy to a private corporation, which really employs a fraction of the people that fishing and tourism industries do, and those are the industries that depend on the things that the road will destroy.
That and some other anti-development positions put SEAC in conflict with much of Juneau's business community, its current mayor, and the Parnell and previous administrations. The organization, however, has undergone some changes in recent years. It's tried a collaborative approach to development conflicts with more negotiations instead of lawsuits. SEAC continues to fight large timber sales and is staunchly opposed by the logging industry, but it also works with small mills, tourism operations, and some other regional businesses.
What makes us a little bit different than some of the larger national organizations is that we live and work alongside everyone else here, and so we see a lot more sides to the story, and that's something we have to juggle, and it's something that we have to work out with our friends and neighbors.
We actually are partnering with SEAC on their food securities efforts.
Shelley Wright is executive director of the Southeast Conference. The Regional Economic Development Organization has long battled with SEAC, but Wright says she's seen some changes.
So I think some of their work they're doing is becoming a little less legal and a little more community-driven, but I still believe that they are very supportive of any of the lawsuits that happen within the Tongass of Southeast Alaska.
CX previous executive director, Lindsay Ketchell, resigned last fall after about 5 years on the job. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting in Juneau.
And last week's live test of the Alaska Tsunami Warning System in Sitka and other coastal communities was just a small component of a much larger disaster drill called Alaska Shield. The exercise simulated a modern-day earthquake and tsunami on the scale of the 1964 Good Friday quake. So, at 5:30 last Friday morning, Unalaska was struck by a fake tsunami that damaged homes, roads, and docks. KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports on how officials responded to the huge scope of the pretend disaster.
Right now, the Alaska Shield drill is still going on in some cities across the state. Communities are acting out a large earthquake and tsunami so first responders can practice dealing with the fallout from a major natural disaster. In Unalaska, emergency workers and even volunteers who were just helping out got a major workout.
We have 250 people displaced and we'll be registering them. Some of them will be housing through the night.
That's William Cross. He usually manages the city landfill, but during the tsunami simulation, Cross was in charge of a pop-up Red Cross shelter at the Department of Parks, Culture, and Recreation. He and his volunteer staff had to sign in dozens of locals and make sure the visitors obeyed the shelter's rules. That would have been a lot easier to do if it weren't for Ben Bullock. During the last drill, he ran the emergency shelter, but this time...
What I am, I'm a controller, so I'm controlling these scenarios. So I'm not really involved with what they're going to do.
Bullock lined up a string of community members to create problems in the shelter. He stood back and watched those so-called scenarios unfold.
Two people had huge knives coming down their legs.
Yes. Those kids?
Yeah.
Shelter staff got wise to the trick. They stopped the young boys and offered to hold onto their hunting knives behind the counter while they toured the facility. But not all of the scenarios were that easy to handle. Laura Leisure signed up to play the role of a confused elderly woman who lost her dog when the tsunami sirens went off.
And I can't find him, and I'm very upset about that. I'm very upset. So I have to go home. My heart's starting to act funny. I'm going to cut myself in tears.
Don't do that.
So my heart's acting funny. I've got to have my medicine. I take it twice a day. How's that?
It was good enough that when Leisure walked into the shelter, volunteers swung into action. They found Leisure's medicine, an empty pill bottle she'd planted at home, and they spread the word to find her lost dog. While the shelter had their hands full dealing with the human side of the disaster, city officials were busy with logistics. At the police station, cops and municipal department heads gathered to form an emergency operations center. From there, they took stock of the fake tsunami damage and coordinated a response to it. Here's Police Chief Jamie Sunderland.
Our search and rescue operations continuing. We probably need to check with operations on that. Does that continue? And if that is complete, we needed to perform some kind of security operations.
That's good practice for dealing with an ongoing natural disaster, but the ability to act fast is just as important. That's why after the earthquake drills ended, the police spent a day responding to their own fake scenarios. Locate a lost hiker stranded at the bottom of a ridge and hop in a boat to recover the body of a possible suicide victim on a remote beach. It might seem like a strange way to end a natural disaster drill, but disasters can take lots of forms. The safest way to prepare is to be ready for anything. Natural disasters and human ones, too. And on Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
And that's all for Raven News for this morning. It's 8 a.m. This is KCAW Sitka. You can listen to or read most Raven News stories again on our website, kcaw.org. To read comments on our stories on Facebook, click on the Facebook link. No registration or login is needed. And to have KCAW News headlines tweeted directly to your smartphone, tablet, or computer, click on the Twitter link. It's 35 degrees in downtown Sitka under overcast skies. The weather forecast for our listening area calls for rain and snow today, except in Yakutat, where it should be sunny. Temperatures today in the low to mid 40s. In Sitka and Port Alexander specifically, you can expect a chance of rain this morning, then rain in the afternoon, with highs around 43 and northeast winds 10 miles per hour, then rain mixing with snow late tonight with little or no snow accumulation. We're heading into NPR's Morning Edition. Good morning.